Well, for the last few weeks, brethren, we've begun a series of sermons speaking about reverse engineering. As you remember, the technical definition of reverse engineering is the process of discovering the technological principles of a device, an object, or a system through an analysis of its structure, function, and operation. So everyone who's not involved with this is already bored, but it gets better from here on out. It often involves taking something apart, for example, a mechanical device, an electronic component, or a software program, taking it apart and analyzing its workings in detail. Now, obviously, this can be done with a mechanical device. It can be done with a digital device, a digital item, a software program, but it can also be true in spiritual things. We have the advantage of being able to take stories from the Bible that God has recorded for us, reverse engineer them to be able to better understand them, whether it's a positive example or a negative example. And as you know, we've been looking at what the Apostle Paul admonishes us to learn from the mistakes of ancient Israel so that we might not repeat them. And if we do have them in our lives, we can begin to root them out, so we don't fall under the same condemnation that Israel did. So what we'll do today is continue to let the Apostle Paul help us reverse engineer the experience of ancient Israel. So if you'd begin with me, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. That's where we've begun the last two sermons on this topic. And let's begin reading 1 Corinthians 10 in verse 1. Now, since we've read this 2 weeks in a row, I'll read it today to you from the New Century Version. Gives a little bit different insight to it. The New Century Version says this: "Brothers and sisters, I want you to know what happened to our ancestors who followed Moses. They were all under the cloud and all went through the sea. They were all baptized," in verse 2, "as followers of Moses in the cloud and in the sea. Verse 3, they ate the same spiritual food and all ate or all drank the same spiritual drink. They drank from that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ." So here's the setup. They had all these wonderful spiritual benefits. They had God right there with them. They could literally see his example, the fact that he was there every day and every night. They'd experienced all these amazing miracles. And then in verse 5, you get the word, but. But in spite of all these advantages, what does he tell us? God was not pleased with most of them. That's the way the New Century Version translates it. How do we know? They died in the desert. So in spite of all these wonderful benefits, they failed. They failed miserably. And they died. So Paul says, now wait a second. Think about this for a moment. Verse 6, "These things became our examples." They became our examples to the intent or for the purpose of, for the reason that we should not. And then he lists these sins that Israel was involved with that we began to reverse engineer. So on the first week, we picked apart this issue, not lusting after evil things as they also lusted. And then last time we picked apart, we reverse engineered this box of the second thing. Don't become an idolater as some of them were. As it is written, the people got up, they sat down to eat, drink, they rose up to play, as you know. So let's now focus on this third, the number three sin, we might say, that Israel got themselves involved with. And I think we'll see this sin is maybe even more 21st century than the ones we've covered up to this point. Verse 8, it says this, we're back to the New King James, "nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell." 23,000. So Peter, or I should say Paul, is telling us that stop for a second and think about this. Now, if you have an old King James, quote unquote, Bible in your lap or on your machine, you'll see that the words sexual immorality there are translated fornication. Sexual immorality is probably a better translation because it involves sexual sin of all kinds, not just having sex with someone before you're married. So it involves much greater, a greater span or area of sexual infidelity. The Greek word for sexual immorality, these two words, is one Greek word. It's pornuo, P-O-R-N-Y-O-O-U, if you're going to pronounce it, pornuo. And what does it mean? Well, it's what we get our word pornography from, often shortened to simply the word porn. Everyone knows what that is. Literally, the word means to act the harlot. Well, we don't use the word harlot anymore. We might use rather crude words like whore or other things like that to go whoring around. What does it mean? It means to have sexual activity with people who are not your spouse. Multiple individuals, no doubt. It literally means to indulge in unlawful lust of either sex. And interestingly enough, this word pornuo is also used metaphorically to describe idolatry. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. So to commit sexual immorality. So Paul is warning the Corinthians. By extension, he's warning us, do not get yourself involved with sexual immorality. The New American Standard Translation renders the verse this way, nor let us act immorally, as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Another translation, New Revised Standard, says we must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in a single day. Now, why would we take the time in God's church services to cover this topic? Isn't this a private thing that should be handled individually and quietly? Well, if that were the case, brethren, then God would not write about it in the Bible. It is in the Scripture. It is a temptation. It is a trouble in our culture. It can be a trouble in the church. So, yes, we do need to talk about this. We need to understand it because we might think that this sin by Israel would appear on the surface to be pretty self-evident, pretty self-explanatory. But since it's listed as one of the five major mistakes that Israel committed that we are supposed to learn from today, could there be that there's more to this sin than meets the eye, than appears on the surface? So let's go back to the book of Numbers to begin to reverse engineer the events that Paul refers to and learn how they apply to our current situation today. Numbers chapter 22. Now, it's interesting, the first two sins that Paul talked about happened in rapid succession almost immediately after Israel leaves Egypt. But this one has a delay. They're just about to enter now the promised land, and Moses in Numbers is kind of recounting the story of what has gone on. Now, you may remember, as Israel goes through various areas on the way to the promised land, they come to the land of the Amorites. And they tell the Amorites, look, we need free passage. We would like to go through your land. We won't eat your food. We won't drink your water. We won't touch your wells. We won't fight your people. All we want to do is pass through. And, of course, as you probably remember, the Amorites attack them, causes a big war, and Israel destroys the Amorites. Now, they were a people filled with paganism and sin, so God was in charge of all this. It wasn't just vindictive. They were to be displaced like the other Canaanites for their sins. But Israel had this tremendous success. And they get to the border then with Moab. And they've got this dilemma. Again, the Moabites are frightened. As a friend of mine used to say, they're scared spitless. they're terrified that the Israelites are going to do the same to them that they just finished doing to the Amorites. So that's where we pick up the story in chapter 22. The children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. It's a large, flat, desert-like, dry area on the opposite side of the river, opposite Jericho. And that's where Israel apparently camped at that time. So they're really in Moabite territory, and they're camping there. Now, verse 2, Balak, he becomes one of the central figures of the story. It says he is the son of Zippor. That's not zipper like your polo has on it, but the son of Zippor. He saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. I should have said Amorites, not Ammonites. Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. You can imagine this, a mass of people, 2-3 million strong, moving onto the plain across from the river. And there they are. You can see them from everywhere. You look down the road and you see what's coming. Moab said to the elders of Midian. Now, the elders of Midian were likely people of more nomadic nature, who kept their flocks in these areas, wandered in and out with the various seasons. But nonetheless, they were allied in part with the Moabites. So he says to the elders of Midian, "Now this company will lick up everything around us, just like an ox licks up the grass of the field." I mean, look at how many they are. They will eat us alive. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. So one of the central figures of our story. He is afraid. So he reaches out for help. He gathers together, first of all, the Midianite elders and says, "We've got to stick together in this or we're goners." But then he reaches out in a spiritual way, we might say, or in a superstitious way. And we get introduced to the other main character in this particular story. He sent messengers, verse 5, to Baalim. We'll just say Balaam, because that's what we're used to pronouncing it. Baalim was the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people. To summarize, in essence, most would say this individual was a Babylonian. He might have been a Chaldean mystic. He lived the river here, probably is describing the Euphrates River. So he very likely was a part of that class of mystics or prophets or shamans, part of the Babylonian mystery system, very likely. And we'll talk about why we think that's the case as we go through this section. Because some would say, well, he talks to God, so he must be a servant of God. Well, I don't think that's very reasonable as we go through, and I think we'll point that out. But nonetheless, he sends to this prophet, this mystic, this shaman, "Look, a people has come," in the middle of verse 5, "from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me." They're right there out on the plain. Verse 6, "Therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me." So his hope is that Balaam would curse Israel so that they could be conquered, they could be fought off, they could be put away. So we look at this and we wonder about Balaam. He had some kind of spiritual connection. We might say a spirit connection of some sort. He may have had a track record. I mean, there's no other information about him, but here are numbers. He may have had a track record that he cursed people and they became cursed. That he blessed people and they became blessed. There seems to be some kind of spiritual connection. Now, again, was he a servant of God? I don't think so. But did he have connections in the spirit world? It would seem so. So the rest of verse 6 says, "They're too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless, Balaam, is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Now, some would say, well, that was all part of the mystic system, that when someone heard that they were cursed by this spiritual man, they felt terrible. They felt cursed. They acted cursed. They did these things. Now, maybe that was the case. But I would suppose that there was some kind of spiritual connection that this individual had with the spirit world. Now, we would tend to say it was a demonic connection of some sort, and that may be the case. Verse 7 then says, so the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the diviner's fee in their hand. Again, that would be a good indication that this is not a prophet of God. This is not one of God's servants. They didn't take payment for what they did. I remember one individual, Mr. Welch and I would have visited years ago, said the reason that he finally left the church that he had been attending is because his father died. And he went to the priest, I won't tell you what church it is, went to the priest and said, could you do my father's funeral? And he said, well, sure, it'll only be, and he gave him the sum of money that he would have to pay the priest to perform a funeral. Oh, that was it for him. You're gonna charge me to bury my father who's been in your church for his whole life? So the diviner's fee would indicate this is not a servant of God. Now again, in the ancient world, it would have been understood. How did God's servant handle these things? Remember, Elisha was going to be paid, wanted to be paid, and he said, don't pay me. Unfortunately, his servant wanted the payment, so he came under a curse for accepting this payment. So not likely is this a servant of God. The diviner's fee, they came to Balaam and spoke to him the words of Balak. And he said to them, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Eternal, as Yahweh. It's Yahweh, as he calls the God of Israel by his name. As Yahweh speaks to me. So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. Now that's where some begin to think, well, he might have been a servant of God. But again, as we go through, I think we'll see enough evidence that not likely that this was a servant of God. But he is now going to inquire, in my judgment, of many God, in this case, the God of Israel. That's the one that obviously is watching over them. So he has to ask this God's permission to do what he's been asked to do. So he says, stay overnight, I'll beseech this Yahweh, and bring you word. Verse 9, then God, Elohim, came to Balaam. He did, he made that connection, and he actually spoke in this vision overnight, or in these words, to Balaam. Who are these men with you? So Balaam said to Elohim, to God, Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent me, saying, look, a people has come up out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth. Now, if this was a servant of God, would he address it this way? How could he not be familiar with Israel's history if he was a servant of God? You see, it just doesn't make sense that this man would have been a servant of God gone awry somehow. Because he talks about Israel as just another group of people. They came out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth. Come now, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to overpower them and drive them out. And Elohim, God, said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. Do you know of any prophet in the Old Testament who was not an Israelite? I can't think of any. Maybe you could think of some. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head. So again, is this a servant of God? Not likely. Was he a shaman? Was he a religious person? Was he a mystery Babylonian priest? Possibly. He has this spiritual connection. He talks to God. God talks to him back. Why is God talking to him? Because it's about his people. It's about Israel. They're about to enter the promised land. So God, yes, says, leave them alone. Do not curse them. So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, go back to your land. For Yahweh, the Lord, the Eternal, has refused to give me permission to go with you. I'm not allowed. So, it's not that he didn't want to go. I'm sure as that diviner's fee left the front door, he must have been gritting his teeth, wondering why this God would not let him go and collect the fee. So verse 14, the princes of Moab rose, went to Balak, said, Balaam refuses to come with us. Then Balak again sent princes. And what's he saying? We didn't offer enough money. That's why the guy didn't come. So it's all about the dollars. Balak sent again princes more numerous and more honorable than they. So now the vice president is sent. And not just the head of the Senate, the vice president or the prime minister. He's got to send somebody more important with more money. And they came to Balaam and said to him, thus says Balak, son of Zippor, please let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will certainly honor you greatly and will do whatever you say to me. Therefore, please come and curse this people for me. Well, Balaam answered, as you know, and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of Yahweh, my Elohim, my God, to do less or more. Now, this is the phrase that has some wondering. He says, Yahweh, my Elohim, my God. Well, again, the word my is not in as a specific descriptor in the Hebrew. The Hebrew literally says, I cannot go beyond the word of Yahweh Elohim. Now, again, why the translators deliberately wanted to insert my, I'm not sure. I don't have an explanation for that. But it's just as easily translated as Yahweh Elohim. I cannot go beyond what this God says. He's not saying this is my God and I worship him. He had to go find him. He had to go ask. So, verse 19, now therefore, please, you also stay the night here tonight that I may know what more Yahweh will say to me. In other words, don't go just yet. Stay the night and I'll check again to see if he's changed his mind. Now again, is this a servant of God? God, you said no, but do you really mean no? I don't think you do. Maybe there was something he was going to do. Maybe something he was going to offer this God. You see, in the ancient pagan world, much like today, but you give God something, and then he's more obligated, or likely at least, to give you something back. And we'll see that play out when it comes to time along the way. They'll give God something in hopes that they get something in return. So stay the night and I'll ask. So verse 20, God said to Balaam at night, or God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men come to call you, rise and go with them. But only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. So it seems in verse 20, God is now giving Balaam the option to go along, to go with them. Now again, he's pushing the limit. God said no. He wants to go ask again. Maybe God will change his mind. Maybe he'll give me more information. You get the same sense here that you find in the book of Job. When Satan goes to God and says, yeah, Job only worships you because of what you give him. Take that stuff away and he'll curse you to your face. And God says you can go this far, but no further. So Satan goes that far. He's not allowed to go further. Balaam is not allowed to go with them. Now God gives him the option. If they come again, go ahead. But you only say what I give you to say. So verse 21, Balaam must have been delighted. Because what was now the diviner's fee was far increased than it was before. So he's got dollar signs in his eyeballs like the cartoons. Oh, he can't wait for this money. Verse 21. So Balaam rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. There was no questioning. Now, literally, did they come to him? What does it say? If the men come to call you, rise and go with them. it doesn't say in verse 21 that they came calling again. Balaam simply took this, seems at least the way the text is written, it seems that he just decided, okay, it's my option. It doesn't say they came. It simply says he got up, he saddled a donkey, and he says, let's go. That might explain a bit more in verse 22 then, God's answer. Then God's anger was aroused because he went. Well, why would God, Elohim, be angry when he just said, if they call on you, go? Well, probably because he jumped the gun. He didn't obey God. He didn't wait for them to call and ask. He simply saddled up his donkey and I'm going. Now again, if this is one of God's servants, why would he be pushing the limits like this? Well, he's not. He's in this for the money. God's anger was aroused because he went. And the angel of the eternal, the angel of Yahweh, we'll talk about that in a moment, took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. What was the angel of the Lord going to do? We'll see that he was so angry that the angel of the Lord was going to kill Balaam for his disobedience, for his pushing the limits, for his going against God's original instruction. It says he, and he was riding on his donkey, and his two servants were with him. Verse 23. Now the donkey saw the angel of the Eternal standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. Why did he have the drawn sword? He was going to kill Balaam. And for whatever reason, I don't think donkeys have supernatural sight, by the way, normally. But God allowed the donkey to see what was about to happen. And it's instructive, isn't it, that here you have this great man who, if he curses someone, they're cursed. And if he doesn't, if he blesses someone, they're blessed. Here's this great man going to have a conversation with his donkey. I think in the midst of all this seriousness, God's sense of humor just shines through here. We're not going to have Balaam talk to one of the servants. We're going to have this great spiritual man taught by a donkey. So if you wonder sometimes why I'm up here preaching, no more questions after that. God can teach through anyone that he calls and uses. Now the donkey saw the angel standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand, and the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. The donkey's running out of the path into the field. He's bouncing all over the place. Balaam is upset. He's angry. Balaam struck the donkey to turn her back onto the road. He's beating this donkey. And again, you get the sense that, look, I am going to get this money. You're not going to turn me aside. What's wrong with you? I want this. And his anger just wells up inside of him. Again, is that a servant of God? I don't think that describes a servant of God at all. Especially when God talks about they should be meek. They should be gentle, not easily angered. Not given to anger and outbursts of wrath, etc. So he's beating on this donkey to get her back on the road. And he does, after it goes around the angel, gets back up on the road. Verse 24, the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. So you picture driving down the road, you've got, instead of a deep ditch on either side, you've got a wall. And this angel, the angel of God, the angel of Yahweh, is right there in the path. And it's not that wide. It's a pretty narrow path. So verse 25, when the donkey saw the angel of Yahweh, of the Eternal, she pushed herself against the wall, tried to squeeze around this angel, avoid the angel, and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall. So you can imagine, if he's angry when the donkey goes off the road, now the donkey smashes him into the wall, and his sandals, you know, the laces are broken, and he's scraped, and he's bleeding, and he is just fit to be tied. So he starts beating on the donkey again, not realizing the donkey now has saved his life twice. by her actions. Verse 26, then the angel of the Lord went further. So the donkey actually squeezed around the angel. Angel jumps, hopscotches ahead, and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn, either to the right hand or to the left. So maybe these walls continued getting more and more narrow. There's no way this donkey's going to be able to go around this angel. So when the donkey saw the angel in verse 27 of the Eternal, she lay down under Balaam, just plopped right down on the ground. There's no escaping this. There's no getting around. She's plopped down on the ground. So Balaam's anger was aroused, and he struck the donkey with his staff. He starts beating on this donkey. Then, verse 28, the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey. This is a once-in-history occurrence, apparently. Now, in the 21st century, you can go to the theater and see, well, not just donkeys talking, but you can actually be convinced that these animals are talking. They move their mouths and they shape vowels and consonants. I mean, computer graphics are so incredibly sophisticated, it can appear that the animals, well, this donkey was actually talking. It was a miracle. God opened the mouth of the donkey. So again, it's just instructive. That Balaam, you think you're smart, you're more stupid than a donkey. Is really what it boils down to. The Lord opened the mouth of the donkey, and she said to Balaam, what have I done to you that you struck me these three times? Why are you beating me? Balaam said to the donkey, because you've abused me. And I'm sure before he even realized it, now he's talking to the donkey, trying to reason with the donkey. The reason I'm beating you is, wait a second, didn't it occur to him to stop? Now again, you wonder, if that donkey talked to you, wouldn't you start running away? Get away from this. Now again, had this kind of phenomenon happened before to Balaam? If you're involved with the demonic world, is this kind of thing possible somehow? Who knows? He didn't seem to have any problem with this. So he explains to the donkey, because you've abused me. I wish there was a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you. Again, this man is completely out of control. And again, when you get in that line of breaking God's commandment of sin, of rejecting the way of God, there's this hardness that sets in. That I would kill you if I could. Hardly God's servant being described there. Sometimes, when we walk the way of breaking God's law, a hardness sets in. No one's going to tell me what to do. Balaam thinks he's the master when he's really the servant. So the donkey said to Balaam, verse 30, Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours? In other words, for years and years and years, apparently, to this day, was I ever disposed to do this to you? So the donkey's actually asking Balaam to think for a moment, consider. And Balaam kind of, well, no. So having this conversation with the donkey. Verse 31. Then the Eternal, the Yahweh, opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way of his, with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed his head and fell flat on his face. Now, was this in worship or was this in terror? My guess is the latter, not the former. The angel of the Lord, verse 32, said to him, why have you struck your donkey these three times? What's wrong with you? Behold, I have come out to stand against you because your way is perverse before me. Your way is perverse. It is contrary. It's going against God. That's what perverse means. It means going opposite or contrary. The way you're going is opposite to me. So again, could this be a servant of God? I don't think so. Servant of God don't do that. They don't go contrary to God's way. The donkey, verse 33, saw me and turned aside from me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely I would have killed you by now and let her live. So the angel was going to execute Balaam for his rebellion, but decided to spare him. Balaam said to the angel of the Eternal, and you notice that the word angel is capitalized in most Bibles each time it comes through. The word angel just means messenger, but we begin to get the indication that this could be a confrontation with the one who became Jesus Christ because of what is said in a few moments. Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, I have sinned, for I did not know you stood in the way against me. Thou, therefore, if it displeases you, I will turn back. People can be really slippery, can't they? If it displeases you. What was the very first thing Yahweh said to Balaam? Do not go. I won't allow it. So now he's asking, he's still trying to weasel out this diviner's fee. If it displeases you, I will turn back. Is this true repentance? And the answer is not even close. Not even close. This is, how do I save my own skin? I really want that money, but if it displeases you, the guy holding the sword 3 feet away from me, I'll turn back. It simply wanted to save his own skin. Then the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, go with the men, but only the word that I speak to you, that you shall speak. Interesting. So Balaam went on with the princes of Balak. So God said, yes, you're allowed to go, but you must only speak what I give you to speak. Now, you may be saying, look, we began talking about the sin of sexual immorality. And we said we were going to dissect that and take it apart to begin to understand it better so that we can avoid it. We can avoid the penalties that come with that sin. And here we are talking about this priest guy and his donkey. What's the point along the way? Well, stay with me. I just like reading that story. No, it does have something to do with where we're going. And that is, how was Israel going to be cursed? How would they be cursed? So Balaam is given this blank check. I will give you, I will make it worth your while. You come here, I will give you whatever you want. Please come and curse Israel for me. And of course, God only allows him to speak blessings. So we'll look at a few of those in Numbers 23, the next chapter. In verse 1, Balaam said to Balak, build 7 altars here for me, and prepare for me here 7 bulls and 7 rams. Obviously, 7 is an important number to God in one sense. The seventh day of the week is his Sabbath. We have 7 annual holy days, etc. It's this number of completion. Balaam both may have had some understanding of that. Nonetheless, the point is, as a pagan mystic, you give the God something, you try to please him so that he'll give you what you want, or at least, at the very least, leave you alone. And the Greeks were wild about that. You pay these gods all these things, hoping that they'll treat you kindly or nicely, or at least, at the very least, leave you alone. That's very typical in the pagan system. We don't give God holiday offerings hoping that he won't curse us. No, it's out of devotion and love to God that we would give our offering. So a very different approach than in God's church. So they set this up. They go through the motions. They sacrifice a bull and a ram on each altar. Balaam then, verse 3, says to Balak, stand by your burnt offerings and I'll go. Perhaps the Lord will come to meet me, and whatever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went on to a desolate height. Oftentimes the pagan priests would go high up into the mountains because, again, you're desolate, you're isolated, and then you're closer to the gods. so you're more likely to get a message. So he goes up further, leaves Balaam down with the sacrifices. Verse 4, God met Balaam, and he said to him, I have prepared seven altars, or Balak speaks, I have prepared seven altars. I've offered on each altar a bull and a ram. I'm giving you something. I'm showing honor to you. You're important. I.e., now give me what I want. Verse 5, but the Eternal put a word in Balaam's mouth and said, return to Balak, and thus you shall speak. And we won't go through it, but he pronounces a blessing on Israel, not a cursing. And of course, once that goes on, verse 11, Balaam says to Balak, what have you done to me? I took you to curse my enemies, and you blessed them bountifully. Now, in my judgment, Balaam is saying, I know. I really didn't want to bless them. I really want the payment, but I can't. I can only do what God tells me to do. So verse 12, he answered and said, must I not take heed to speak what Yahweh has put in my mouth? Well, Balak said, well, maybe it's perspective. Remember, the ancient pagans felt that each god was god over a specific geographic territory. And if you then got out of that territory, you were under some other god's authority. So Balak seems to think that if we change locations, maybe there'll be a better connection. So Balak says to him in verse 13, please come with me to another place from which you may see them. You shall see only the outer part of them and shall not see them all. Curse them for me from there. So part of his reasoning is, oh, you saw all of those people and you got scared, so you bless them instead of curse them. We'll go to another place, a little bit different perspective. Maybe God's closer there. You'll only see a small part and you won't be as afraid and you'll be able to curse them. Well, you know the rest of the story. Balaam is told by God to bless them a second time. Notice down in verse 18. He took up the oracle and said, rise, Balak, and hear. Listen to me, son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and he will not do? Or has he spoken, and will not make it good? Behold, I've received a command to bless. He has blessed, and I cannot reverse it. So he goes on and on and on about this tremendous blessing. Notice down in verse 25, Balak says to Balaam, well, in essence, stop it. Neither curse them at all, nor bless them at all. I mean, if you can't curse them, don't say anything. It's kind of like what we say, you know, if you can't say something good about your neighbor, don't say anything at all. I mean, if you can't curse them, just shut up. Don't just pronounce blessings, because not only is Balak there, but all his princes are there as well. And they're all hearing this blessing. It's making Balak look terrible, and it's scaring everybody else. So Balaam says, look, I said to Balak, did I not tell you that all the Eternal speaks I must do? Why, because he wanted to be totally obedient to God? No, it's because he was afraid to step out and receive the wrath of this God. Not that he was a man of God. I don't think that's true. I don't think we can prove that very well at all. Drop down to chapter 24. In verse 1, when Balaam saw that it pleased the Eternal to bless Israel, he did not go, as at other times, to seek to use sorcery. That's diviners' enchantments. You see, he was not a servant of God. He was this shaman from probably Babylon. And he used these incantations to stir up the spirit world. And he realized, this being is so powerful, there's no way that I can do this and stir this up and get my way. It says, he set his face toward the wilderness. He looks out over Israel and now pronounces another blessing. I mean, he just goes on and on and basically says, you're all going to die and Israel's going to win. And that's not very good news when you've hired this guy to curse your enemies. So verse 10 of chapter 24, Balak's anger was aroused against Balaam and he struck his hands together. In other words, he's wringing his hands. He smacks them together, just wringing them. He's so angry. Balak says to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, and look, you have bountifully blessed them these three times. Now, therefore, flee to your place. I said I would greatly honor you, but in fact, the Eternal has kept you back from honor. So Balaam said to Balak, did I not speak to you when your messengers, whom you sent me, saying, if Balak were to give me a house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Eternal? You see, it's not a Christian's viewpoint to see how far we can push God. How much can we get away with? I can only go this far. How many seconds before the sun actually sets do I have to stop working? Could it be right at sunset? Do I work right up to it? Oh, well, Christians aren't pushing the limits. They're always trying to be safe, pleasing to God. So I could not go beyond the word of the Lord to do good or bad of my own will. What the Eternal says, what Yahweh says, that I must speak. So now he says, I'm going to leave. What we interestingly then find out is that that's not all that happened. That's pretty much all that the book of Numbers tells us. There's a little bit more we'll look at in a moment. But Balak basically decides, yes, it's time for you, Balaam, to go home. Somewhere in the midst of that time period, Balaam gives advice. Well, how do we know that? Well, let's turn, you might hold a marker here in the book of Numbers. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. Turn with me to Revelation. You might think, wow, that's an odd place to go. The book of Revelation mentions Balaam. Revelation chapter 2, specifically mentioned in verse 14. Now, obviously, we all know that Revelation 2 and 3 contain the messages, God's message, Christ's message to the seven churches. And in the midst of the message to the fourth church, he gives a mention to Balaam and actually reveals something about Balaam we did not know from the story up to this point. He tells those at Pergamos, in verse 14, I have a few things against you. It's not that Pergamos did everything wrong. He complimented them on a number of things in the previous verse, but that's immaterial for us at this juncture. I have a few things against you. The church at Pergamos had some problems. I have a few things against you because you have there those who hold the doctrine of Balaam. The doctrine of Balaam, the word doctrine simply means teaching. So there were some in the church in Pergamos who held to the teaching, the thinking of Balaam. And then it goes on to explain what that thinking was, what that sin was, who taught Balak. So we had no indication back in the book of Numbers that Balaam actually said, I know you're sending me home, but for a lesser fee, I can give you some advice as to how you can work this situation out. At least that's what we can assume. Balaam's not going to give advice for free. That's not the kind of person he is or was. So he taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel. What was that stumbling block? What's the reasoning here? Well, look, Yahweh will not allow me to curse Israel. But if you get Israel to reject Yahweh, he will curse them himself. You don't have to do a thing. Interesting. So he teaches them how to get Israel to sin so that God will punish Israel and the Moabites will be fine. He taught the children of Israel, or he taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel to eat things sacrificed to idols, it's a sin we talked about last time, and to commit sexual immorality. Now, we've kind of come full circle to what Paul was saying. Neither don't get involved with sexual immorality as Israel did, because in that day 23,000 die. So what did Balaam teach Balak to do? You've got to get Israel to sin so that God will remove his blessing and then they'll be cursed. How do you get them to sin? You attract them with very attractive things. Now let's go back to the book of Numbers and take a peek at Numbers chapter 31. We'll come back to chapter 25 in a minute. Numbers 31. Moses is kind of reviewing this whole thing. So now we're past the event, and Moses is looking back to remind Israel what had happened and the disaster that took place. Numbers 31 in verse 15. Let's read in verse 14 first. Moses was angry with the officers of the army, with captains over thousands, captains over hundreds, who had come from the battle. So now the Moabites have been defeated. And what do all the soldiers come back with? Moses said to them, verse 15, have you kept all the women alive? I mean, all these Moabite women, you've left them alive? These idol-worshipping women? Look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam. So it was Balaam's idea. How do you entice Israel? With good-looking women. Now, good-looking women of them by themselves aren't wrong. I happen to be married to one. But in this setting of sexual immorality, you entice through a sexual means, you wrap it together with worship of gods, and what you have are temple prostitutes, whether male or female, coming out, enticing Israel through sexual means. So it goes on to say, look, these women caused the children of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Eternal in the incident of Peor. And there was a plague among the congregation of the Eternal. And as Paul tells us, 23,000 got involved and had to be put to death. Now let's go back to chapter 25. Maybe the last verse of chapter 24 gets us into the context. Chapter 24, verse 25, Balaam arose and departed and returned to his place. Balak also went his way. Somewhere in the middle of this was all this counsel, was this teaching that Balaam said, I know I can't curse them, but you'll be able to. If you get them to sin, God will curse them himself. So in chapter 25 and verse 1, Israel remained in the acacia grove, and the people began what? To commit harlotry with the women of Moab. So it was with beautiful women, sexualized women, that Israel was enticed into sin. They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. We talked before how the sin of lust and the sin of idolatry become tied together. And now we see lust, idolatry, and fornication or sexual immorality all tied together as well. It's a fascinating study in that regard, very instructive for us. So they entice Israel with great food. Food's offered to sacrifice. I mean, when you have a feast to your God, you don't have bread and water. You have the best of the best. And then you're served by beautiful women who are badly clothed and who entice these men, and probably women as well, into this idol worship. And so Satan knows exactly what to do. He does this with the pagan holidays to this day. He ties it together with good food, family events, everyone's together, you're partying, there's lots of booze involved, and that's the way the world parties. So this is a giant street party with thousands of Israelites being lured into this sin. The Nelson Bible Study says this, Balaam's plan worked. The women of Moab and its Midianite allies sexually enticed many of the Israelites to join with them in their sexually immoral, idolatrous practices. You see, all the ancient temples had temple prostitutes, not all of them, many had temple prostitutes. Some were female and some were male. Like today, you kind of appeal to any kind of perversion that is out there. And so these people would entice, and through this, I mean, God has caused the sexual union to be something of great pleasure, great joy. And you detach that from marriage and you get into sin. And boy, but it's such a strong pull. So that's where Israel had come. They'd been drawn into that. So it goes on to say, this was likely presented as an offer of national friendship. Doesn't that make sense? Why would these Israelites be involved with the enemy's women? Well, we're giving you these women. We're presenting them as a gift, as a sign of friendship. We're all in this together. We're going to be neighbors. We'd like to give this gift to you. So that's very likely, very possible. So this was likely presented as an offer of national friendship and perhaps even a new way to worship God. Yet it was, in fact, flagrant rebellion against the true God. No doubt, temple prostitutes seduced Israelite men into sexual rites linked with their religious sacrifices to Baal or Chemosh, also known as Molech. This was not just another time of trouble. This was the most serious challenge yet. The people had been seduced into joining the worship of Baal, and it was Baal worship that they had been sent to Canaan to eliminate. So Israel was enticed sexually by what feels good, separated from what is good. And that's a very important distinction to make. God wants sexual union to be pleasurable between husband and wife. But when that's separated from that, it just becomes raw selfishness. I want what I want. I want what feels good, and I'll do whatever is necessary to obtain that. So we begin to dissect this and see what we learn from this. What do we apply from this? And again, this isn't a sermon about sex oven by itself, obviously. But it's important for us to simply be clear and be honest. God designed sexual expression to be a number of things. One, an expression of tender love between husband and wife. A bond between husband and wife that's shared with no other. It's an expression of tender love. Now, oftentimes when you see sexual things portrayed these days, it's almost violent. It's just sad that something God intended to bind a husband and wife so close together, something shared with no one else, becomes this cheapened, violent expression, which is very, very sad. God also designed sexual expression to be an expression of fidelity, loyalty between husband and wife. I share this with you and no one else because I love you. I'm dedicated to you. My life is committed to you. I'm willing to sacrifice for you. It's an expression of fidelity. And then thirdly, it's a symbol of fidelity to God himself. Sexual expression in marriage is a symbol of our fidelity to God. In the same way that we share this relationship with no one else, we share this relationship with God with no other God. He is first and he is only. I am the Lord your God. You shall not worship other gods. It's not just I'm one of many. He is God, the one and only. So sexual fidelity is a symbol of our fidelity to God. So one of the reasons I stay faithful to my wife is to show, to tell God I'm going to be faithful to you. It's an exclusive relationship. You're always going to be number one and vice versa. So any expression of sexuality outside the boundaries of marriage is sin and resorts to simple selfishness. I want pleasure. I want what feels good to me. Doesn't matter who has to pay the price for me to look at this stuff online. I'm enjoying it. Well, what about that person who made these? It's just so sad. The kind of things they go through to sell to selfish people, it's very challenging. And we're all tempted in that way. So Paul says, look, this is a temptation. Do not give in to, do not be tempted in the same way, the way Israel did. 23,000 fell dead that day when God stepped in. So one who commits sexual immorality indulges in selfishness. They're not being faithful to their future spouse if they're unmarried, and they're certainly not being faithful to their spouse if they're married. And they are then, in essence, marring individuals if they have yet to be married. So we don't want that. Same, obviously, for adultery, any sexual expression outside of marriage. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 6 before we close. Two other scriptures. 1 Corinthians 6. We'll begin reading in verse 12. Again, the Bible is very clear about these things. And I hope in your family you can be open about these things, discuss them as is appropriate for your situation, your children's ages. Because if we think they're not exposed to these kinds of things at quite an early age, we have to be sure that that we aren't naive, frankly. They're exposed at a very early age to these things. Whether we like, as much as we try to protect them, it's very difficult to do so. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 12. Well, let's just go to verse 13. It makes more sense to start there. Verse 13, food's for the stomach and the stomach for foods. But God will destroy both it and them. He was talking about foods offered to idols. It doesn't really matter. You can eat. It's food. Don't worry about it. But then he goes on to say, now the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the eternal. The way we use our bodies is either honorable to God or it can be dishonorable to God. So if we break that sexual union, we're being dishonoring toward God and toward our spouse or future spouse or toward the institution of marriage, which represents, in essence, the family of God. Body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. God made it for a purpose. God raised up God raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? In other words, join them together? Certainly not. Or do you not know that he is joined to a harlot as one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. Sex is not sport. It is something that affects us deeply. And to do this with someone other than our spouse causes no end to troubles. We were counseling with one man many, many, many years ago in Albany, New York. He was a prospective member. He was hoping to be a part of the church. God seemed to be calling him, but he had this terrible background sexually, and he just struggled with this. And he said, this just means nothing to me anymore. There's nothing special about this. There's nothing. I can't even imagine myself now being married because it's just so cheap. It just means nothing. And he just felt sorry. Now, he never did become a member of the church at that time. Maybe he has since. We've never kept in touch, so I wouldn't know. But it just illustrates this, that, boy, you bind together with multiple people, we've got problems. There's something very special about saving yourself for your spouse and then being faithful to your spouse all of that time. It goes on, let's drop down to verse 15. Maybe we'll back up to verse 15. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ, in other words, we're supposed to be a part of God's church, Christ's body, and make them members of a harlot? Well, certainly not. Or do you not know that he is joined to a harlot as one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. So the conclusion, verse 18, flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have from God? You're not your own, for you are bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So sexual immorality is described in Galatians as one of the works of the flesh. It's an incoming, it's a selfish work that Christians make sure stays in its proper context. Do not be tempted. Strive to fight that. Now we could go on and on and on about strategies as to how we might do that. What we have to do to make sure that we're not tempted by the Moabitesses of our day and age. Let's go to Ephesians chapter 5. That's not the purpose of our sermon today, is to dissect this. Ephesians 5, in verses 1 through 3. Therefore, Paul writes to the Ephesians, be imitators of God as dear children. So he's saying, in the same way that your son might follow you around, Dad, and do the things that you do and imitate you, or that little girl will follow you around, Mom, and want to do what you do. And how often we think that it is just so precious to see these little ones do exactly what Mama's doing or what Daddy is doing. So he's saying, think of that in that role. Follow God, imitators of God, in the same way the little child wants to be just like Dad. Verse 2, and walk in love, as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. Christ's life is characterized by self-sacrifice, not selfishness. Sexual immorality is selfishness. It's inward. It's all about me and my pleasure, what I want, not the consequences for me later on or the consequences for others. So he says in rest of verse 2, walk in love as Christ also loved, gave himself, sweet-smelling aroma. Verse 3, but fornication, same word, sexual immorality, all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not even be named among you as is fitting for saints. So where we want to be is to get to the point that people can examine our lives from top to bottom and not see any hint, as Paul says here, of sexual immorality, that it's not present. So, brethren, Israel suffered a great deal because of their sin in the wilderness. Paul tells us we're to reverse engineer that sin and learn from it. So let's do our part to flee sexual immorality. Let's learn from the example of Israel and strive as we progress forward to the kingdom of God.